This is The Guardian.
Welcome to Weekend, a podcast that helps you switch off from your busy day-to-day and find entertainment and inspiration in the best Guardian and Observer writing from the week. You can either listen to this as one podcast or play each article as individual listens. Just scroll down the description on the podcast page for the timings of what we are featuring. Coming up, if the Tories who want to run the capital think London is in New York, shouldn't we be worried? Asked Marina Hyde. What can you change about your lifestyle at 60 to ensure you live to 100? And star of Sex Education, Gillian Anderson, on being brave, her resting face, and a much-anticipated book of sexual fantasies.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-.
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
In Norway, a woman's boyfriend forgets who she is overnight. In Detroit, a man is arrested, but he was never at the crime scene. In Spain, disturbing pictures of young girls have appeared, and no one knows who's behind them. Something strange is happening. A collision between people and artificial intelligence. Discover more in The Guardian's new series, Black Box. Listen wherever you get your podcasts. All episodes out now.
Now, it was crazy for the Tories to flag up UK crime using footage of the New York subway. But, observes Marina Hyde, if Susan Hall is their candidate for mayor, wisdom is in short supply. Read by Brani Rule.
So sad to see the Conservative Party talking down Britain in its new attack ad for the London mayoral elections, which, among other deliberate and unethical lies, included footage of commuters fleeing false reports of gunfire in New York's Penn Station in 2017. That bit has now been edited out, but what remains of the ad purports to be a 90-second portrait of life in the capital since London Mayor Sadiq Khan seized power. Given that Khan has twice won the London mayoralty in free and fair votes, this feels somewhat punchy talk from a party led by an unelected man who himself seized power from the salad-vanquished political corpse of an unelected woman. But look, what's the worst that can happen if political parties tell blatant untruths to people, debase campaigning standards, and conduct knowing assaults on trust? If only there were places in the world to which we could point in order to answer that question. If you haven't seen this advert, it's a grainy black and white montage supposedly showing life in a crime capital of the world, London. Apart from all the obviously disprovable fakery and dishonest manipulations and misrepresentations that we'll come to in a minute, the entire ad is inexplicably voiced by an actor doing a bad American accent. Why? He doesn't even go here! And yes, I get that on the one hand this opens me up to the possibility of the actor who voiced the ad identifying himself and crossly declaring himself to be an actual American, perhaps hailing from one of the regions where they have unconvincing American accents. On the other hand, this course of action would involve him identifying himself as the person who voiced this embarrassing ad, so I'm feeling relatively safe. Indeed, given I live in London, I am feeling relatively safe anyway, what with the Crime Survey for England and Wales reporting that residents of the capital are less likely to be victims of crime than across the country as a whole. Anyway, the ad. Suffice to say that every creative decision taken on the script seems to have been signed off by a beta version of ChatGPT or someone who has suffered a recent head trauma. Sample writing: gripped by the tendrils of rising crime, London citizens stay inside, the metropolis teetering on the brink of chaos. In the depths of these narrow passageways, growls the unconvincing American, tread squads of ULEZ enforcers dressed in black, faces covered with masks, terrorizing communities. But do they? Of similar concern is the decision to use a scare graph that, upon closer inspection, appears to resemble a graph showing crime in England and Wales significantly overtaking crime in London. But hey, it's a graph. It looks the part. It's got two lines crossing in a way that looks the right stripe of worrying. The wider purpose of the ad is an attempt to cast London as a Gotham desperately in need of a Batman. Off the back of that statement, can I bring myself to type the words, "Enter Susan Hall"? Yes, I think I can, just for the mirthless laugh. Enter Susan Hall. If you're not familiar with Susan, she's the Conservative candidate running against Khan, and is arguably the final form in a long series of Tory mayoral hopefuls, of whom the only question that can ever be asked is, oh wow, where on earth did they find that one? Where did they find Susan? Possibly on account of her lurid social media history, she's been described as a populist, and for much of her time since selection, has come off as the best kind of populist, one who is not very popular. Having said that, the picture has distinctly shifted in recent months, and noises from the Labour campaign are increasingly strangulated. There is at least a small possibility that Hall could win, which would ironically be one of the most compelling arguments that London is having some form of existential crisis. None of which is to suggest that Khan is the most exceptional of rivals. For my money, he has been a very indifferent mayor, and anyone seeking a third term should be expected to be judged and attacked on their record. But the fact that he isn't, in ads like this, does matter. It does matter if parties fake scenes of terror in a London Underground station that turn out to be in New York. It does matter if untruths are told because it's easier than fighting truthfully. And, as discussed here previously, it matters when the other side do it too. It mattered when Keir Starmer decided to release an attack ad featuring a picture of a grinning Rishi Sunak and the slogan, "Do you think adults convicted of sexually assaulting children should go to prison? Rishi Sunak doesn't." All of these things matter and don't result in anything good. We already know where assaults on truth lead because we've seen them happen in other countries and in some cases our own, and people on all sides have spent a lot of the past decade lamenting it. The tragedy is that we all know it, and even the people who come up with the ads know it. But they're still doing it because they think that it works in the very short term. Yet, in the long term, it really, really doesn't. Which makes doing it anyway pretty criminal in itself.
That was, "If Tories who want to run the capital think London is in New York, shouldn't we be worried?" by Marina Hyde. Read by Bryony Rawl. Next, can a late convert to well-being undo decades of beer and barbecues? Phil Doust has a health MOT and gets some worrying news about his heart. Read by William Vanderpoy.
I am sitting in a consulting room, talking through the results of an unusually thorough health check. The doctor seems happy with most of them, but he lingers on the squiggly lines of my ECG. A chart of the electrical signals in my heart. he's found something called a prolonged PR interval. I'm very happily married to a PR, so this sounds quite pleasant. But then he explains that P and R are points on the squiggly lines, and that I probably have first-degree heart block. I feel a little chill. I guess these are the risks when you try to find out more about your health. But ignorance doesn't feel like bliss when you turn 60. How much longer have I got, you want to know? How much of that will be fit and happy? And okay, I'm now getting free prescriptions, which is nice, but is that because I'll be needing more medicine? You might call me a late convert to well-being, after spending most of my 20s, 30s, and 40s underactive and overindulging. In the past decade and a half, I have learned to appreciate my body and what it can do. First, when I lived in the French countryside, it was hiking, skiing and swimming. Then I discovered running. I enjoy all of this, and it makes me a little less grumpy. I don't smoke or drink, and I do my best to eat healthily. But I can't help wondering if it's enough. My dad died of lung cancer at 67. He collapsed at home while I was away, and I didn't see his body until it was at the undertaker's. But 38 years on, I remember his blood on the bedroom carpet, me and my mum soaking and scrubbing so it wouldn't stain. Mum died alone in hospital 25 years later, at 88, after a series of strokes. Hers was not a good death, lingering for weeks in a strange bed, never fully conscious, washed, changed, fed, and rotated by others. In all that time, she sleep-spoke a handful of words, half of them in French, her parents' first language. She seemed uncomfortable, and no one expected her to recover. If I could have pressed a button to end her suffering, I would have. Instead, when everyone agreed it was wrong to keep her in this half-dead, half-alive state, the doctors stopped the drips that were feeding and hydrating her. Days later, although it felt like centuries, her body finally gave out. We didn't have the consolation of believing that she was happy in her final years. She was never one to complain, but from the outside, it wasn't much of an existence. Frail, confused, pretty much housebound. I don't want to die like either Mum or Dad. Too soon or too slowly. I want many more good years. Then, something quick and painless. Maybe out of the blue. A runaway bus. A falling piano. I can't decide if I want time to say goodbye to my wife, the kids, life, and the world. Or just to go, not be there. Clicked off like a light. What I do know is that I want to put off that moment when my body becomes a source of pain rather than pleasure. I'm doing what I can. I now live in London and run 30 to 40 kilometres every week, go to yoga at least once a week, and try to fit in a bodyweight or high-intensity interval training class. I got a personal best in my last half marathon. At 77 kilograms, about 12 stone 1 pound, I have lost 33 kilograms, 5 stone 2 pounds, since my days of beer and barbecues. It took me far too long to give up booze. And when I look back at all the stupid things I did and all the money threw away, well, I wish I'd never started. But during the pandemic, after almost 40 years of heavy drinking, I finally packed it in. I must have been heading for a stroke or a heart attack, but I seem to have avoided that alcoholic iceberg. As far as I can tell, all I have to show for those decades of abuse is wine-etched teeth and some broken veins. I take two pills every day, one for my blood pressure, another for an enlarged prostate. But other than that, I reckon I'm in great shape for 60. I definitely feel fitter than I did at 50, 40, maybe even 30. But I am also aware of how lucky I am, and how quickly all of this could be snatched away. and it wouldn't take anything as dramatic as an accident or a serious disease. In the winter of 2022-23, I spent months almost immobilized after spending far too long working on a laptop. What began with a stiff neck and tingling in one arm turned into wave after wave of agony that kept me off work and sent me to A&E. It took me weeks to get the painkillers I needed. And while the exercises the physio gave me made a difference, progress was slow. I finally turned the corner with a shockingly intense massage. I cried twice in 15 minutes. First, as I got dressed afterwards, stunned by how much it had hurt. Then again, as I did my shopping in Sainsbury's, amazed and grateful at how much better I felt. An earlier massage from a different therapist had ended when I fainted and wet myself. This is not unknown when your neck is being manipulated. Something to do with the blood supply being disrupted to your brain. But that was no consolation as I headed home in a pair of borrowed tracksuit bottoms. Looked at one way, this was a urine-scented blip in an otherwise rosy tale of late-life sportiness. To me, it's a reminder that the older you get, the less you should ignore those dull warnings about workplace ergonomics or the dangers of processed meat. And I haven't even mentioned sleep. That's the one area where I'm really struggling. I have slept badly almost all my adult life. Lucky to get an unbroken night or to rack up 6 hours in total. There may be a physical reason, but I think it started when my dad was dying. I remember so many dreams of rotting teeth, a nightmare often blamed on bereavement, and was entrenched by years of boozing and clubbing. And sleep is no luxury. A lack of it increases the risk of obesity, type 2 diabetes, cardiovascular disease, anxiety, depression, Alzheimer's. I've tried almost everything to fix my insomnia, from Tai Chi and mindfulness to melatonin and sleep restriction, where you drastically cut the time you spend in bed. I did not enjoy staying up until 1 a.m. night after night, the alarm set for 5 hours later. As for pills, while they usually knock me out, they also leave me woozy and washed out. Many experts will tell you that what a lot of pills produce is unconsciousness, not sleep. And that doesn't give your body a chance to repair itself. So insomnia still feels like a great pillow of Damocles suspended above my head. A few months ago, troubled by hitting the big 6-0 and clueless about how long I had left, I made the half-serious resolution to live to 100. I instantly felt liberated and empowered, with something to aim for. It's not an entirely ridiculous hope, with the route to a longer life becoming clearer as scientists explore everything from intermittent fasting to the gut microbiome. There is no magic bullet for longevity. Leslie Kenny, a co-founder of the Oxford Longevity Project, tells me when I call her hoping for just such a thing. But there are lots of steps that will take you in that direction. For example, she says, even if you're 70 years old, you can gain an extra year and a half of life by making some very small changes in diet. You could call a century of life unambitious if you're channeling the tech entrepreneur Brian Johnson, who spends millions every year pursuing his goal of don't die. Or Aubrey de Grey, the gerontologist who talks of humans achieving longevity escape velocity. But a lot of this sounds like wishful thinking. I can't forget the artist stroke architects Madeline Jins and Arakawa, who declared death old-fashioned and claimed you could become immortal with the correct, horribly uncomfortable environment. They barely made it into their 70s. I'll be writing about some of this in the weeks, months, and, who knows, decades to come. Both the out-there live-forever stuff and the mainstream, maybe live-a-bit-longer stuff. For a sanity check on the likelihood of making it into triple digits, I ask an actuary. Every time you take out life insurance or a pension, an actuary will have calculated how long you, well, someone like you from a similar area, of a similar age, background, and so on, are likely to live. This is an industry where accuracy counts. And, as Stuart MacDonald, the head of longevity and demographic insights at Lane, Clark, and Peacock points out, you can't simply use the most widely quoted figures of 78.8 years for men and 82.8 years for women. This period life expectancy at birth, as it is known, is badly named and tells us almost nothing about how long people alive today can expect to live, MacDonald says. It is a calculation based on the death rates experienced recently. In other words, it's all about the past rather than the future. And those 78.8/82.8 figures are for the whole of England, which makes them even more useless. Life expectancy varies by more than 20 years between the healthiest and least healthy parts of the country. A more relevant figure is cohort life expectancy at age 60, which strips out the effects of infant and childhood deaths and adds a couple of years to reflect assumptions about future improvements in mortality. For England as a whole, this leaves us with 84 years for men and 87 years for women. We're moving in the right direction, though still miles away from de Grey's escape velocity. It's even better in my affluent good health cohort. Reflecting your personal circumstances, a non-smoking, health-conscious journalist living in the southeast adds another 4 years to your life expectancy, MacDonald tells me. That brings my semi-bespoke life expectancy up to 88. If I was a woman, the figure would be 90. And what are my chances of making it to 100? About 1 in 20. Or 1 in 12 if I was a woman. How can I improve those odds? And what might hold me back? I'd love to find out from my GP. But although he gives me a quick medication review, talks me through my most recent blood tests, and reassures me about my prostate and blood pressure, he has patients backing up. And I want more detail than I can get in a 15-minute phone call, which is how I end up at Bupa, getting tests and recommendations from a doctor and a health advisor. By the end of the 3 hours, I know far more than I ever have about my cholesterol level, kidneys and liver, blood count, iron levels, vitamin D, heart rhythm, risk of developing diabetes, stroke or heart disease, BMI, basic metabolic rate, energy requirements, insomnia, severity index, mobility, flexibility, grip strength, etc. There's also a spell on an exercise bike to measure my overall physical fitness. There's a lot of good news. Excellent cardiovascular fitness, 1% chance of type 2 diabetes in the next 10 years, as well as the less pleasant revelation that I'm 5 foot 9 inches. While I've always thought of myself as 5 foot 10 inches, well, that's what it used to say on my passport and what several nurses and doctors have told me in the past. I'd like to think I'm having a bad height day, but it's more likely I'm shrinking. We lose an average of a centimetre a decade once we hit our 40s. I also have a body fat level of 27.9%, which sounds enormous but is apparently just slightly above the ideal. My cholesterol could also come down a bit. The real worry, of course, is that prolonged PR interval. It may just be normal human variation, Dr. Sanjeev Chohan reassures me, but he'll be sending the ECG to a specialist. Checking the NHS website as I wait for the verdict, I learn that while serious cases may require a pacemaker, heart block normally only needs to be treated if it's causing symptoms. A few days later, I get the all clear. The cardiologist agreed that you do have mild first-degree heart block. That word mild makes me very happy. But feels this is a normal variant and does not need any further investigation. Phew. Back in the consulting room, when I ask about the most important thing I should focus on, the doctor doesn't mention my heart. It's just, sort your sleep out, which is comforting and a little frustrating as I've tried so hard to do just that. But then he provides lots of practical advice, from the name of some new pills I should investigate to the possibility I have sleep apnea, meaning my breathing might be stopping and starting during the night. It's not quite as awful as it sounds, especially if you can avoid having to use a CPAP machine, which pumps air into a mask that you wear while you sleep. How long can I expect to live? I asked this man, who has just prodded my spleen, checked my vitals, and spent 60 minutes discussing my physical and mental health. Now he knows me, surely he'll say at least 95. Into your mid to late 80s. Is the underwhelming reply. And how much of that will be healthy? Well, I've had 70-year-olds here doing Iron Man, he says. There in the consulting room, all I can remember is that Iron Man is some kind of gung-ho endurance race. It turns out to be the triathlon from hell, stretching over 141 miles, 226 kilometres, and often lasting 13 or 14 hours. I think he's trying to be encouraging, but I'm not blown away. Sure, Iron Man, but 70? That's nothing. I'm in this for the long haul.
That was I'm 60 and want to live to 100. Will my years of drinking and inactivity be a problem? By Phil Doust. Read by William Vanderpoel. We're going to take a short break now. We'll be right back with the second half of this episode in a moment. Don't go anywhere.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Welcome back to Weekend. Finally, her uncanny portrayals of famous women have brought her legions of fans. Now, as Gillian Anderson prepares to play Emily Maitlis in the pivotal Prince Andrew interview, the actor talks to Eva Wiseman about performing, soft drinks, and side hustles. Just a warning, there's a bit of bad language in this episode. Read by Bryony Rawl.
I have a tendency to be cast as those types of women who have unbelievable brains, says Gillian Anderson, running her hands through her glamour of blonde hair. Because my resting face is intellectual, as if I'm thinking about Proust or the world order, when in fact it's usually, actually, dinner. The next unbelievably brained woman Anderson will play is British journalist Emily Maitlis in Scoop, a film about the process of securing her 2019 Newsnight interview with Prince Andrew. This was the interview in which he discussed his friendship with sexual predator Jeffrey Epstein, his inability to sweat, and the Woking branch of Pizza Express, and in 50 fast minutes managed to do more damage to the royal family than 5 seasons of The Crown. This will not be the first time Anderson has played a real person on screen. After growing up in London and moving to Michigan at 11, she found community in the punk scene as a teenager before lurching into wild fame in her 20s as Agent Scully in The X-Files, later being cast as Wallis Simpson, Eleanor Roosevelt, and memorably, Margaret Thatcher. Now 55 with three children, she is both curious about and resigned to her status as world's sexiest woman. When Emily Maitlis heard Anderson was to play her, she told GQ, "I have teenage sons, so that was hormonally complicated." There has been a low hum of distrust online about the way that Newsnight interview has so quickly become somehow an entertainment franchise. This Netflix film, in which Rufus Sewell plays Andrew, will be followed by another separate series, in which Ruth Wilson will play Maitlis. And in 2022, there was a comedy musical about the interview that rhymed Pizza Fiorentina with Friend Soliciting a Minor. One criticism has been that we are memorialising a moment before it has been processed, but I was relieved upon watching Scoop that it is dark and suitably thrilling. "I had the same reaction," says Anderson. "It's properly interesting and surprising, isn't it?" It sort of goes without saying by now, all of us having enjoyed Anderson for many decades as an actor who brings an elegant mischief to her intellectual women, that she is exquisite in this role. But here she appears somehow to be even more Maitlis than Maitlis herself, a meta-Maitlis maybe, describing with her mannerisms and demure ferocity a glittering kind of feminine power, and elevating the story so it becomes less about Prince Andrew and more about the collaborative efforts of a group of women who, as Anderson says, hold power to account. They film the interview first, with minimal rehearsal. "Sitting opposite Gillian as Emily Maitlis was an extraordinary feeling," Rufus Sewell tells me. "Her relentless, laser-like focus and uncanny vocal and physical resemblance to the woman I'd been studying alongside Andrew all this time made it suddenly quite easy to squirm." He's worked with Gillian before. "I've always been a fan of hers, and the palpable sense of will that she brings to her character. It's a formidable thing to be up against, and I relish it. She made it very hard for Andrew, and somehow easier for me." Because Maitlis is involved in the competing series, she declined to meet Anderson, so it was a shock when the two accidentally came face to face recently at a charity event. "I had literally driven in from the country, having spent a week in mud with the kids on the side of some hill. I didn't have any makeup with me, didn't even have a brush to go through my hair. And then all of a sudden, there's Emily Maitlis and she looks like a movie star," Anderson hoots. Because she had been studying her for months, she, the actual movie star, went in for a hug, which sounds perhaps like it was a mistake. "She was very sweet, but very boundaried. Very boundaried," Anderson recalls. In the research, Anderson started to notice similarities between her and Maitlis's work. Specifically, she remembered trying to cry during an emotional scene in her 2000 film, The House of Mirth. "But they were shooting in a flight path, and there was a fucking bumblebee in our faces." "There are so many human scenarios like this," Anderson says, "when things don't go to plan on a job. And in those moments, all the facts fly out of my head. But with the Emilys of the world, it incentivizes and invigorates them. Somehow the facts remain, and they have a sharper access to them because of the frisson that's created in the moment." She briefly marvels. "I identify with the pressure and expectation," says Anderson, "but crucially, she always relies on a script. How impressive, how daunting, the idea of being able to just go with whatever happens in front of you," she says in her liquid accent that slips from London to America within a single sentence. "Did the character stay with her?" "That feels a bit creepy, like taking ownership of something that's not mine. And also, you know, she's had experience with stalkers. She doesn't need another example of that from me." The only character, in fact, that has lingered in Anderson long after the work ended was Blanche DuBois. "With all the characters I've played, even Scully, who I played for the longest, it feels like there's a sheath between me and them, whereas I feel like Blanche could come back in a split second." This was the Young Vic's 2014 production of A Streetcar Named Desire, when Anderson said she immersed herself so deeply she was hanging on to reality by a thread. Talking to the director after one show, she had a vision of a train. It's not in heaven, but somewhere in another dimension. A train that has continuous cars that's just going and going ad infinitum. And everybody who's ever done a Tennessee Williams play is on that train. And once you do it, a part of you can never get off, she says. She giggles a little nervously. I'm getting very esoteric here, but I do wonder, you know, when people talk about the muse or connecting to something that's bigger than themselves by immersing oneself into a Rothko or Bryce Marden or a Tennessee Williams, you somehow enter into this realm of understanding. There's no coming back. It felt dangerous. Your job sounds, I offer sensitively, a bit bonkers. She replies, it's totally bonkers. I thought about this recently, going to the BAFTAs and the Golden Globes. To which we should note, Anderson wore a dress embroidered all over with vulvas. All of these artists who have put everything into the work, blood, sweat, tears, money, put their families second to this singular vision, and then it doesn't get nominated. I wish there was an award for effort, for even actually getting the thing made at all. Bonkers. She's remembering The House of Mirth again, when one particularly horrendous review about my performance almost made me quit acting. The mixture of that and the bland reception was a real eye-opener for me, a rude awakening to the fickleness of the industry. She pauses. I don't know what it is about you, but we always go so deep, she says. So we talk instead, cheerily, about soft drinks. Last year, after trying to wean herself off Coca-Cola, Anderson launched a functional drink called G-Spot, and as well as learning about adaptogens and nootropics, she was surprised to learn about herself. What she learned was, she says with some majesty, I too am product. When colleagues started referring to brand Jillian, taking into account not just the drink, pitched smartly as a kind of anti-wellness wellness product, but her new production company too, she felt deeply uncomfortable. At first I kept saying, can we not frame it differently, please? And then I started to realise, actually, that it makes sense to embrace it. She explains, I've been in the industry 30 years and have a significant fan base that has become obsessed with various characters that I've played, whether that's Scully or Stella in The Fall, or Blanche or Jean in Sex Education. There's something that women are getting from them and the alchemy of me being attached. For a while after The Fall, in which she plays a ruthless, urbane cop, she heard about bumper stickers that said, what would Stella do? That's a form of empowerment, whether in imagining oneself as Stella in order to ask for the raise, or investigating oneself as an individual. What you want. What you want to put in your body. What you want out of your life. What you want from your job. What you want from your partner. What you want in bed. And feeling courageous enough to ask for it too. She grins. Choose not to do what everybody else is doing. Choose not to go to the gym today. Choose to eat the chocolate bar. The more Anderson talks, the more it seems as though embracing brand Jillian has been surprisingly therapeutic and energizing for her, as though identifying what appeals about her to others has clarified who she wants to be. She continues, I'm not a guru. It's just about encouraging anyone who identifies as a woman to courageously embrace that part of them that knows, ultimately, intuitively, what's good for them, and be brave enough to say yes, or brave enough to say no. Has she always been that brave herself? It took me a long time to do it in romantic relationships, but I could do it pretty much everywhere else. How? I ask. It's come from circumstances in my life. It's come from where I grew up, how I grew up. Being peripatetic, being a TV star at 20, having a child at 25. It's all of it. While her side hustles are under a spotlight, Anderson's private life is just as demanding. Though she prefers not to confirm the name of her partner, tabloids suggest she's back together with her partner of 4 years, Peter Morgan, the screenwriter best known for The Crown. Her daughter is 29, and her sons, she tells me proudly, are professional sportsmen. I mean, the youngest is 15, so it's hard to call him a man, but that is their life and their focus. Which means my life and their dad's life, ex-husband Mark Griffiths, is filled with facilitating that dream for them. It involves a lot of driving and us, you know, doing whatever they tell us to, basically. The juxtaposition between the two halves of her life, one glamorous, the other frazzled and suburban, is oddly thrilling. It's exhilarating and terrifying, she says, of supporting her sons. It's emotional too, trying to let them have their own journey but not trying to fix things. They work hard. She smiles, a new kind of smile. And they put me to shame. It is a particularly interesting time to interview Anderson, as Brand Gillian, she adds, is all about trying to answer every question as honestly as possible. That can be dangerous too, though, can't it? Authenticity has a price. Yes, I'll get into trouble, she smiles, from time to time. She has had to be slightly cautious recently when writing introductions to the chapters of a book she's editing. The book came about after Anderson put a call out for women to share, anonymously, their sexual fantasies. This has been a gorgeous kink in her career, the pivot to sex. It happened after the popularity of her role as charismatic therapist Jean Milburn in Sex Education. And it has led to Anderson taking ownership of her former status as sex object and turning the gaze outward with humour and depth. If I weren't in the public eye, as I am, I'd be able to be much more frank when writing about how the fantasies relate to my own experience. And there have been versions of intros that I've done where I've shut myself down because I could see that Daily Mail headline, you know? Amid the 174 fantasies in the book is hidden one of her own. We've found a balance of what feels genuine and true without the whole book becoming about me. Yes, I have identification, and hopefully many women reading it will have identification too. But it's about women collectively. It's an exploration of our internal worlds, she says with precision. Has she found the editing process titillating? It's become more titillating in the edit. Being able to have one thing flow into another and poetry to be revealed in the process, it has become exciting and titillating and surprising and moving and beautiful. And it's taught her two things. Even though this is a fearless exploration, there are so many things that are still untouchable subjects or too risky for big companies or individuals to embrace without consequence, she says. The second thing it has taught her, I need to focus my mind. What's the message? What's the moral? What are you left with at the end of the day? What do women want? And do they have to stay in fantasy? There's a lot of yearning for what women don't have or feel afraid to ask for. Has it, then, felt like a political project? You know, everything is politics, particularly when you steer into the subject of women. The book, she adds, is called Want. I am curious where Brand Gillian goes next, in terms of business, and to see where this self-reflection takes her. Yes, it feels like a valid and intriguing, sometimes exciting, creative journey to be on. She admits, after a pause, I didn't expect it to be. I've been in therapy for a good portion of my life, and so I thought all of the questions had been asked, or that I was fixed. But this is a different way of looking at things. Her eyes widen theatrically. And I guess I'm along for the ride.
That was I Get Into Trouble. Gillian Anderson on being brave, her resting face, and much anticipated book of sexual fantasies by Eva Wiseman. Read by Bryony Rule. Before you go, we think you should check out our new series on artificial intelligence. It's called Black Box. Each episode follows a different story of the real-world consequences of humanity's collision with AI. Search and subscribe to Black Box wherever you get your podcasts. All episodes are available now. That's all from us. This has been Weekend, a Guardian podcast. If you're enjoying it, please make sure to like, subscribe to, and rate the podcast. Maybe even leave us a nice review, or let us know what you want to hear more of. Just search for Weekend wherever you get your podcasts. This week's articles are read by William Vanderpoy and Bryony Rawl and presented by me, Savannah Ayode-Greaves. This episode was produced by Silas Gray. The executive producer is Ellie Bury. Join us again next Saturday. Thanks for listening.
This is The Guardian.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
This message comes from BOF sponsor eBay. You'll know real when you get it. It'll say eBay Authenticity Guarantee. And you'll feel it. Maybe it's a head-turning handbag, a watch that says it all, jewelry that makes you look like the gem, or sneakers and streetwear so fresh every step feels fly. eBay gets it. So look for the blue checkmark next to that thing you love and be confident that every inch, stitch, sole, and logo is checked by experts. With eBay Authenticity Guarantee, you can trust that feeling of real is always in reach. Ensure your next purchase is the real deal. Visit ebay.com for terms.